Well, we do appreciate you coming. I think one of my favorite groups for me to address is those who are in less than ideal situations. Now, many of you students have never known anything but a good life. You've known a Christian home, most of you. You have known a loving family. You've known a good church. You really have never faced any pressure. Now, some of you have faced great pressures. But there is coming a time that normal will be gone. And normal will never come back. And one of the things I did with the freshmen, incoming freshmen at Northland for many, many years, I would meet with them for the first 2 weeks of their freshman semester, first year, and start them on building their personal biography of God. Who is God? A pastor was walking with me after he had dropped one of his children off. We were going to the dining hall. And he said, "What do you see as the greatest need of young people coming as freshmen from our churches and our families?" I said, "That they know God." I don't have to think long on that, that they know God. Not just know him in salvation, but know him in his characteristics and his attributes. And as that is built into your life, you are going to forget 90% of your classroom work until you need it. You'll be digging notes out 5 years from now when you need it, but you will forget the majority, but you will never forget the attributes that you are learning about your God. And as I have traveled these last many years, I can't tell you how many of our alumni have said, "You know, Doc, we were kind of aggravated about having to get up early and get into that chapel at 7 in the morning to learn to start having that intimate time with God. But what has stood us firm," and some have lost children, some have had horrible scenarios, lost mates. They say, "You know what stood us strong during that time? Was the attributes of God that were in our mind that we began to have as a hook and a focus." And as we heard in chapel this morning, the know your God, know his characteristics. He loves us with a perfect love. And when we begin to realize that, we realize then that nothing that he allows to come into our life is for our detriment. And my focus in my messages on revival is our goal in life from the day Adam was created, that we might be reflectors of the nature and the character of our God. As the Trinity met, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness." What was that? Glorify God. Now, what does that mean? Well, let's suppose someone from the news network was outside this door, and we understand there's a Christian meeting going on, and you're going in. We understand you are believers, and if I understand correctly, your purpose as a believer is to glorify God, and you would say, "Yes, that's right." Well, could you explain what that means? Well, it means make sure he's glorified, which means, well, don't do anything that doesn't glorify him. Which means, well, just make sure everything is to his glory. And the newsman would say, "Thank you for explaining that. I never understood that before." What does it mean? When you go back to Genesis 1:26, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness," our job description and our purpose for life was given in that verse on the day of Adam's creation, to be a reflector of the nature and the character of God. Now, in the Old Testament, glory was the weightiness, the heaviness, the awesomeness of the character of God that carries into the New Testament. But then you add doxa, doxology, orthodoxy, paradoxy, and one of the roots of doxa is opinion. So whether you eat or whether you drink or whatever you do, do all to give a proper opinion of the nature and the character of your God. And when you begin to live your life on that level and you start making decisions on that level, it eliminates a lot of things that you say, you know, I could do that, but it's not going to give a good picture of my God. And so you say, I eliminate that from my life. When you put yourself on that level, all the do's and don'ts that bug you sometime would not even be a factor in your life. And as you look at the aspect of why are we alive, we are alive to glorify God. Now, how God chooses to be glorified. Sometimes it's very painful. In fact, he told Peter, when Peter asked Jesus, when he said how John would die, and Jesus said, what about me? And he told Peter how I am going to be glorified in your death. As tradition states, Peter was crucified upside down, did not feel worthy to be crucified the way Christ was crucified. But interesting phrase, how I choose to be glorified in your death. The world is going to get a right opinion of what you are like. My topic is brokenness. And we start with the premise, what do we do when normal is no more? Everything is normal. Naomi in the book of Ruth, chapter 1, normal life, normal family, normal husband, normal children. Famine came as a result of what was happening during the period of the judges. And here Naomi then, instead of staying in the house of bread, Bethlehem, she and Elimelech move to Moab. And the husband dies. That normal is gone. Then Mahlon and Chilion, the two children, die. That normal is gone. No more coming home in the evening, smelling a nice warm supper meal, sitting down with the normal evening activities, normal go to bed time, normal husband time. Gone. And Naomi showed what happened when there is circumstantial bitterness that comes into the life. To me, there are two major bitternesses. One is circumstantial, one is relational. And I'm not going to deal with the relational in this session. I'm going to deal with the circumstantial bitterness. And Naomi literally flawed her testimony because she refused to let God be God in that scenario. And God worked over and above. Here's Ruth, follows her, clings to her. When Naomi was teaching a proper view of her God, of Yahweh, Ruth clung to that. After Naomi told her, go back to your country and to your gods. Basically, my God let me down. Because the first thing that Satan will do when things go wrong in your life is the question, why? Why would a loving God allow that to happen? Why would that be? Why would God allow some young person to be abused? Why would God allow something to happen that in my mind does not glorify him? And so when you look at Naomi now moving back to Bethlehem, and here came Ruth with her. And Ruth was working in the field and Boaz comes. Now you see the amazing grace of God coming through very hurtful circumstances. And Ruth, a Moabitess, the offspring of an illegitimate relationship that Lot had with a daughter. And then she meets Boaz, and Boaz's mother was Rahab the harlot. And so you have this son of a harlot, Boaz, this Moabitess come together and they're placed into the line of the Messiah. That's what you call amazing grace. And sometimes you don't understand quite completely, why is God allowing this or why is God allowing a certain thing to go that way? And normal leaves. In fact, I'm trying to get a book written on this topic. What do I do when normal is gone? I have been counseling myself this way for the last 31 years. What do you do when normal is gone? I've used it hundreds of times. Phone rings. You get information. Devastating. Loved one killed in an accident. Or you get devastating news about a physical problem. Devastating news about a character flaw in a child. And you stand stunned. And you think, what now? Number one, you have to acknowledge that is true. This is true. I am not going to wake up tomorrow morning and this not be true. This is true. And that might take a time. It might take a week, 2 weeks. I've known those who have lost loved ones, lost a mate, have gotten up in the mornings believing that mate is there, or they'll hear a car pulled in the yard, oh, he's back. That goes on for weeks. Finally, the acknowledging takes place. That is true. And then secondly, you accept that. Now, those who do not accept that scenario will end up dying bitter. Because accepting that situation is basically saying, I completely trust the hand of God in this scenario. Shall not the God of all the earth do right? It's not convenient for me, but I completely trust him. I accept what he has allowed in this scenario. Sometimes it takes a year, maybe 2 years, wrestling back and forth, struggling. Some never accept it and die, in my opinion, a premature death just from the stress that is put on the body in that scenario. Then number three, you adapt. Normal is gone. Create a new normal and make a ministry out of that new normal. Charlene and I have been through things in our life where we couldn't see through tears. We couldn't see through the tears with aching hearts. And yet those circumstances that God allowed in for years and years and years, I get phone calls from overseas, phone calls from mission fields, phone calls from families and pastors across. Unless we know you went through this scenario, how did you handle it? And you make a ministry out of that scenario. Because now that person understands he or she has been there. Now a pastor will go and make a call on maybe a widow or widower. And they will appreciate the compassion shown and the fact that you're there. It's pointless to say much. What is a point is to be there. But sometimes it's much better to just keep your mouth closed and let your presence communicate. But now someone who has been there, that person comes in, and you know what that person does? Minister to the heart of that one who is just going through the scenario that the other person had gone through, and proved the grace of God mighty in that scenario. So there was a ministry made out of that. I just talked to a lady within the last 2 weeks, and I used this analogy. She said, let me give you an example. And she gave the example of what she had gone through in the scenario, and she happened to be in one of those abuse situations for years as a young person, for age so-and-so to age so-and-so, had been abused by an uncle. She said, I didn't quite understand that. She said, when I acknowledged that was true and accepted, and she said, I indeed have ministered over and over and over and over. And she said, in fact, it was that couple's retreat we just did up in Pigeon Forge. One of the ladies stayed right after one of the sessions. We just did a couples conference up there. And she was beaming. And her husband was standing there. And so it proves that. Then the fourth point is accelerate. You don't look back. The key to success is to have a bad memory and have good vision. Forgetting what is behind and pressing forth unto that which is before, I press to the mark of the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. And so you don't look back. You look forward to what does God have? How is God going to use this? And when you come out the other side, you will see why God allowed what God allowed. Remember, you have an enemy, and Satan is begging God for permission to prove that you are a hypocrite. When he told Peter, Satan is begging to sift you as wheat, but I prayed for you. Singularly to Peter, then plurally to the group. But Peter was the one he knew was going to be the point of attack. And as Peter was arguing with God, Peter said, no, I will never forsake. No, I will never do that. But God was trying to get Peter to that point of understanding what he really was in that time and in that scenario. So you acknowledge it's true, you accept it, you adapt, and then you accelerate. And you go on from there, not looking back. Now, let me define brokenness. Because brokenness is the system, is the process that God will allow us to go through that we might become reflectors of who he is. I define brokenness as the shattering of my will so that my every response is controlled by the indwelling Holy Spirit. It's the shattering of my will so that my every response is controlled by the indwelling Holy Spirit. So I say, as Christ said, not my will, but thy will be done. It's not what I wish. It's, Father, I accept your will in this scenario. I also define it as the ongoing process of sanctification. From the time of your new birth till the time that you are in the Lord's presence, there is an ongoing process of sanctification. And the brokenness is that ongoing process. 1 Thessalonians 5:23, and the very God of peace sanctify you wholly. And I pray, God, your whole spirit, soul, and body be preserved blameless unto the coming of Christ. 1 Thessalonians 4, this is the will of God for you, even your sanctification. So that sanctification process that is ongoing is going on in that way. And so Paul was praying for the Thessalonians that the very God of peace would sanctify them wholly, that their whole spirit, soul, and body would be blameless. In other words, not sinless, but they would be blameless in their characteristics as they have that process of sanctification taking place in their life. Now, what's the purpose of this? Well, number one, I put to bring to usefulness and to shape us into the image of Christ. Nothing will drive you to the bosom and drive the fruit of the Spirit as a reflection from you, like things that are beyond what your human flesh can handle, to bring to usefulness and to shape us into the image of Christ. And then number two, to keep me from reacting on the basis of my five senses. Now, God uses that process to bring into my life so that I am not reacting on the senses that I have within me. Because our tendency instantly is to blow up or to question God. And then thirdly, to glorify God by reflecting the fruit of the Spirit. So as we begin to realize that God allowed this scenario to come in, this is what he has brought into my life. God is giving me grace to handle this during this time. And by God's grace, I want to be a reflector of the fruit of the Spirit in my life. Now, brokenness is divinely planned. Number one, brokenness is divinely planned. You have to understand, it is the overruling hand of God that is allowing these circumstances to come into the life. You say, well, God is not going to cause something that is sinful. No, but God will use some choice that you have made that has brought a consequence. God didn't cause that, but he will use it to bring you to a point of brokenness in your life. And the sooner you respond to that, the more quickly you will find that Christ-like conformity. God is interested in what you are becoming, not just what you are right now, but he is leading to what you are going to be becoming. So we have to understand it is divinely planned. We see this worked out in the life of Peter. What do you think of Peter? Peter was an example of strength. He was an example of loyalty, faithfulness, courage, strong service. But what God was wanting Peter to see, Peter, you are not strong. You are weak. You are not loyal. You're going to be disloyal. You are not faithful. There's going to be unfaithfulness and failure. Peter thought he was an example of courage. Jesus showed he was a coward. And Peter was an example of service. But Jesus said, Peter, you're a stumbling block to my cause. But Peter didn't see it. Now, was Peter usable? Absolutely. Who was preaching at Pentecost? But it wasn't this Peter. It was the broken Peter preaching at Pentecost. Because Peter denied, no, Lord, I will never forsake you. If the whole world would turn against you, I will never turn against you. I will be loyal. I will be faithful. Jesus said, Peter, you don't know what you are. And God will zero in on what we think is our strength and prove us weak in those areas so we learn to become dependent on him. And you will learn this through your life as students and those who are here who have been through life a bit, that anything that God brings into the life that makes me dependent is good for me. You might get in a scenario while you are still here in college and you want to be independent. You want to be 100% in control. God will bring a situation in that's out of your control. And you know what that does? Makes you dependent on him. And you will say, Lord, I know I don't like this, but I know this is good for me because this is making me dependent on you. Not only is brokenness divinely planned, as we will see in Peter, but it is also perpetual. You cannot rush God's breaking, but you can delay God's breaking. You cannot speed God's breaking process up, but you can delay God's process by your hardening of your will. See, what God wants to do with us is get us to the I am level. There are five levels. There's a cliche level. That's what I am not. That's horseplay level. There's an information level. That's what I know. I get up, I communicate what I know. You as a teacher will get up and communicate what you know. When you pastor or you teach in a classroom, you're communicating what you know, but that really doesn't expose the real you. Then you communicate what you think. That is a little deeper level of communication. Now you are exposing a little bit more of yourself on that level because now you're expressing what you think. A topic comes up, and now suddenly you're expressing what you think. And somebody said, boy, I didn't see that before. Now I hold up my phone. A great offense to some people. That's my pack. I lived all those years in Detroit as a Lions fan. But when I played high school football, our football team went down in 1957, what is now Lambeau Field opened, and the coaches took our whole football, our high school football team in 1957 to the opening of what is now Lambeau Field. And so I always had a Packer fan in my background, and this was a Christmas gift to me, this cover, not the phone, the cover. And I was coming out of Tokyo not too long back, and some Vikings fans were on there. So there is satanic influence, worldwide satanic influence that is going on. And they commented on my Packer cover. And I said, yeah, but y'all helmets have those devil symbols, those horns on them. Well, all of a sudden, we were talking about weather and so on. All of a sudden, this brought them to what they thought, that maybe I had some brain issues or something. The fourth level is emotional level, what I feel. Now, that's an outburst of anger or tears. But now you're saying, oh, I see a little more of that person now. I see tears coming down. I never saw that in that person. Or there's an outburst of anger. See, I never saw that in that person before. But the peak level of communication is the I am level. And that peak level is the I am level, not what I am not. It's not what I know. It's not what I think. It's not what I feel. It is what I am. And that is where Jesus was taking Peter. He was going to keep working Peter until Peter admitted the I am level. We see that in Isaiah. Woe is me, I am undone, because a new glimpse of who God was. Got a new view of who he was. I am undone. Job said, I've heard of thee by the hearing of my ear. Now mine eye seeth thee. I abhor myself. I repent in dust and ashes. And at one point, Jesus looked at Peter. And after the draught of fish and saw the miracle power, Peter said, depart from me, for I am a sinful man. You can only imagine after the rooster crowed and Jesus looked at Peter. And you know, there's something about a gaze. You young people know what that's like when you were teenagers at church. Mom and Dad were sitting near the front and you were sitting near the back with a group. There was a ruckus in the back and Mom turned. Lasers. And this boy, 100 feet away, goes like this. It was the look. Ever wonder why they wrapped a cloth about Jesus' head when they were beating? I don't think it was out of compassion. I wonder if they could not stand the gaze of compassion that he had for those who were doing the persecuting. But there was something about the gaze, and Jesus looked at Peter. And what did Peter come to realize? Peter came to realize to the I am level. Peter came as a broken person. Oh, I'm loyal. I'll never forsake you. I'm faithful. I have courage. I'll stand. And to prove his lack of courage, a little girl comes. And he swears, I don't know him. I don't know this man. And Jesus finally got Peter to the I am level. It was that I am level Peter preaching at Pentecost. Because he had to wait to get endued with power from on high, as we heard on Monday night. So brokenness is perpetual. God will continue to work on us to shape us into that image. And then brokenness is painful. Painful because of the tool that God uses sometimes. And that tool might be a person. The tool might be a mate. How many we have counseled. Deep, deep hurts. A mate where the vows were taken at the altar. And the lifetime commitment was made. And yet there's a breaking of that commitment because of one's choice of unfaithfulness. Or maybe there is some other aspect. A friend. Or some type of a relationship that comes in. And as you see the pain that is involved in that. Now you will go through your life, if you get into a scenario, you name the pain. Was it a person? A circumstance? A loss of a job? Those of you who will get into pastoral work are going to be under fire. Sometimes the kids hurt badly for dad because they hear the talk and they know what they're saying about dad is not true. And boy, that can set some. What a lot of kids will do, they'll just turn off for a period of time, and they get old enough, they say, we'll see you later. Because there is that person or that circumstance or that scenario that has come into the life Maybe it's one of your own children when you get married, or maybe some of you who are here, maybe it's one of your own children. Or maybe some scenario that you never saw coming. I did not see that coming. Everything was going through life. You were cruising. Successful. Secure. Suddenly, everything changes. And now what do? You go back to the point of saying, God, you have your way. You do what you need to do in my life to shape that Christ-like character into me. Now, just imagine in your mind, what have you been through up to this point that's painful? Now, it might be something as simple as angry at God for how you were formed, for how you look. You wish that you had some. I remember I did 42 years of CIT up at the Wilds. Probably should have been doing nursing home bowling, not still speaking to teen leadership. Why have Colonel Sanders come and do teen leadership camps? But one of the questions I would ask, because I was trying to find points of hurt or points of subtle anger against God, I would ask the question, is there anything about yourself physically you don't like? One girl said, my nose is too big. I said, if it's sucking air, what's the difference how big it is? I said, God gave you a nose to suck air, not for decoration. But we in our society, we have to have decoration noses. We're not going to accept the big snaz. You get to breathe more air. I told you, you get to breathe more air than the rest of us get to breathe. Don't be upset about that. But it might be many, many things that you would never even talk about. But yet, to you, it's a very, very painful thing. I don't know what went on in the life of that shooter that killed those 17 in that high school yesterday in Florida. But the little glimpses of news that I've seen, it seemed like this person was a reject. And he makes the statement, one day I will make my statement, and my statement will be final. I mean, you have to understand the depth of pain, and there is no excuse for that, but the depth of pain that a person goes through that finally says, I'm hurting so badly. And I don't know anything about this shooter down there, but oftentimes someone who has said, I've had my last rejection. A lot of it's the brought on themselves, but the point of the matter is how we need to be sensitive to hurting people, how we need to go out of our way to minister to those who are desperately in need, touching those who have less than an ideal scenario. And then brokenness is purposeful. And I want us to go to Hebrews chapter 12. It's perpetual, it's painful, it's planned by God, but then it is purposeful. God is shaping something into our lives. Getting some type of adjustment. Remember flying back from California. Did a meeting. In fact, Doc Horn was there. And got a phone call from our kids. All of our children happened to be home at that time. Though they were all married. And they said, we have mom at the hospital. And my wife, who's sitting back here now, had never been sick. I mean, I didn't remember her taking aspirin even in all of our years of marriage. So I wasn't concerned. It was some kind of a pain. And I thought, well, maybe appendicitis or gallbladder or something. So we pulled off the interstate in the freeway there in Los Angeles. And we pulled off and prayed. And we prayed that God would take care. In my spirit, I was thinking, I know this isn't a serious thing, but we do want to transfer this over to the Lord. And then I said, if anything changes, let Northwest Airline know, because Northwest was still, before Delta bought them out, they were still the main carrier out of our area. And I said, let them know, and they can alert me in Minneapolis. And I really didn't have any expectation of any follow-up calls. The plane gated in Minneapolis, and I got into the terminal, and the PA system blared my name. Pick up the white courtesy phone. And I thought, that's not good. Someone else, one of our other staff, took the call and answered it, came to me. And if I recall properly, the message that they gave was that my wife's heart had exploded. And I'm standing in Minneapolis Airport from normal to panic. You know, when you get news, your emotion goes, God's in charge, human panic. God's in charge, human panic. God's in charge. And it wasn't like 10 minutes here, 10. No, it was like a yo-yo. Up and down emotionally. And I'm standing there thinking, kids, grandkids, I'm thinking, did I just hear what I thought I heard? The information was not accurate. What had actually happened, her descending aorta dissected. She was filling up with blood, didn't realize it. And I don't have time to tell the miracle story, but it is a miracle story. 9 hours before getting into surgery with that problem, the surgeon told me, we've had people have this happen in the hospital and die on us, much less a 100-mile ambulance ride. And I'm standing there, and we get on the next flight. Doc Horn's sitting across the aisle from me, and I'm looking out the window. I don't want the plane. I didn't want the plane to land. I wanted to just stay airborne, because I knew when I landed, I knew what information I would receive. I didn't want to hear that my wife was with the Lord. Glad for her, but panic for me. And my mind was just swirling. I wasn't knowing quite how to deal with this. We finally landed in Gaeta, and it was just 3 weeks before 9/11. And so people could still come up to the gate and meet you at the gate. And Tim and Barb Corey came to the gate, and I got off the plane, and Tim said, Charlene is still alive. Well, I didn't know what all that meant, because in the meantime, as our daughter Lisa and Tammy were there, and my son Stephen, they told Lisa, we don't know what's wrong with Mom, but we're going to put her into a room and observe her overnight. And my daughter Lisa said, you're not observing anything overnight. You're going to find out what's wrong with her right now. And they got so upset with my daughter that they ordered a scan. And when they saw the scan that her aorta had dissected, they didn't want to look at Lisa, but they finally said, Lisa, your mother is not going to live. There's no way we can get her to Green Bay in time. So get your siblings, and we're going to give you an opportunity to say goodbye to your mom. Then they tell Charlene the chopper had to land. There were 70-mile-an-hour winds that day. The chopper that was coming had to land. It couldn't fly, and that was of the Lord, too. She would have died in the chopper. And they loaded her on a gurney. They were loading her into the ambulance that was going to be taking her down to Green Bay, 100 miles plus. And they told her, we want to give you a chance to say goodbye to your kids. Now, suddenly, normal is no more. Put yourself, you get a phone call. Your dad calls you. Mom's been in an accident. They're giving her less than 24 hours, and you fly home, and you have 10 minutes to say what you want to say. Or put yourself in the place of a mother who has 10 minutes to say what she wants to say. Charlene doesn't remember this, but Tammy was standing right there by the ambulance door, and Charlene told Tammy, "Tell Dad I'm at peace with this. And I'm sorry this is happening when just before school is opening." And then she told Tammy where our $38 was hidden. It's down to $24 now. The doors closed. My son followed, got up to 115 miles an hour following, and had to back off. We looked at the ambulance bill, 58 minutes from Iron Mountain, Michigan to Green Bay, Wisconsin. A code went out. One of Clifford Patch told us, he's in charge of the emergency department in Pawnee. He said, "We got this code, which never comes. That's to block all lights with emergency vehicles, state police, sheriffs. Every light was blocked by a police car, so the ambulance never slowed down. My wife is between life and death, and I am. All this had gone on while I'm in the air. I'll tell you, I was dealing with some things in my heart, saying, God, I need your wisdom in this. I totally trust you, but then I panic. God, I completely trust you, but I panic. And went through another scenario way before that, and I argued with God from Monday through till Friday morning. I was up at night. Two scenarios at the same time, one with a physical injury. Charlene stayed during the day at the hospital, and I stayed at night, and I said, God, I was saying in my spirit, God, I'm not going to thank you for this because I don't believe this is your will. And I'll tell you what, I didn't win that argument. I gave up. What a dumb head. I mean, that's pretty dumb. And I said, okay, I rest in this. Because I would have had to move back out of civilization into the woods because Charlene was my only hope within civilization. And got to the hospital. The PA kept coming out saying, Charlene's still alive. Charlene is still alive. She'd come out every 15 minutes or so. Surgery lasted about 9 hours. And finally the surgeon came out midnight or after and said, I want to meet with the family in the conference room. And he said, all I can tell you right now is Charlene is alive. We don't know how long the paralysis will last or if it'll ever leave. We don't know how much brain damage there is because of the hours of blood loss. But all we can say is she is alive. That's all I needed to hear. So when the green light came on in critical care, I went in the room. I didn't recognize her. Her body was totally swollen, and there were pipes and things connected. And I stood by the bed. I said, "That's not my wife." They said, "No, that's your wife." So swollen, I couldn't hardly recognize her from a distance. And when I stood next to her, her hand moved like this. And I said, "I think she wants to write something." So they brought a legal pad and put a pen in her fingers, and she wrote aneurysm clearly and accurately on that legal pad. I told those medical, I said, "She's smarter in a coma than I am in good health." I said, "I couldn't spell it, and if I could spell it, you wouldn't be able to read it." In a long process began. You know what? It was a new level of trust, a new realization of the greatness of God, a new realization. Now, some of you had an experience where the mate did not make it. But it's the same scenario. What is God doing through that scenario? And now you look 17 years later, in good health. They called her the miracle girl. And Dr. Abu Jarma, one of our dear surgeon friends, passed away last fall, and we went to visit him before he passed away. He was one of our surgeon friends in Green Bay, a Christian, knew our surgeon. And he said, you know what? Your surgeon told me, and this was 16 years after, said, you know, Dr. Abu Jarma, your friend was a miracle. And she indeed was. How do you have an aortic dissection go that long and live? The paralysis left eventually. She had no speech for August, September, October, November, December. She couldn't talk. Surgeon said, I probably severed a nerve on going up to that vocal cord. We'll deal with that later. And then in January, she started squeaking a little. She said, did I squeak? And I told the doc, don't worry about that. I said, when we argue, you know, I'll make my point and I'll shut my eyes. And that's what I knew, she was going to make it. But not to think, I don't take a second for granted with her. But you know what? There are other things. Normal didn't come back that we've gone through in life. But God is still God. God is on the throne. When you decide in your life, okay, how am I going to react as we close here? Hebrews chapter 12, verse 3, for consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. Ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou. So number one, we can despise this chastening. That's option number one. We can despise that chastening. Nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. Option number two is to faint and quit. Give up on everything. Son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure, that's the third verb, endure the chastening. That's the three options. You despise, you faint, or you make the choice to endure. And the enduring means I completely trust God. God, I acknowledge it's true. I accept it. I am going to adapt to it. And I am going to not look back. I'm going to look forward. I will endure. Why? Verse 10, because it is for our own good. Why should we endure? Verse 10, for verily for a few days our fathers chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. It is for our good, and secondly, that we might share in his holiness. You see, the ultimate goal that we are to be glorifying God in the midst of these trials and testings and difficulties, that we are to realize, God, this is for my good. Why? Because in it, I am sharing in his holiness. What does that mean? I am reflecting his nature and his character. And people can see in the way I suffer what God is like, what our God is like. I think one thing humanism and postmodernists will understand is they know Christians suffer differently. They don't seem to get bitter or get angry, and at least not in the external part, and they suffer differently. And then in verse 11, now no chastening for the present seems joyous but grievous. Nevertheless, afterwards it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. So number three, and the benefit is peaceable fruit of righteousness that comes as a result of that. We see the fruit of the Spirit now that is coming out of the life because God allowed that. Now, if you continue to argue with God, continue to question God, I don't think it's wrong to question God. But if you continue to question God, you're going to end up losing. It's natural to question God instantly, but it's spiritual to totally trust him to see what his end is in that, and you yield a peaceable fruit of righteousness. And then number four, sanctification, verse 14. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. And that is that cleansing that comes from a conscience that is void of offense, and the sanctification process and the holiness that comes as a result of that. This is the will of God for you, even your sanctification. And if we can just learn that God allowed this to come into our life to shape us more into the image of his dear Son, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them called according to his purpose. For whom he did foreknow, he did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his dear Son, who is the firstborn among many brethren. What does that mean? He is the first of many who would be just like him later. Christ was the first pattern for us to be manifesting. It's not saying, well, everything works together for good. No, all things work together for good to them that love God, called according to his purpose, for who he knew he predestinated to be what? Conformed to the image of his Son. And you say, Lord, you allowed this into my life. I've been fighting with you. I've been in deep depression. I would encourage you to read Psalm 77, those of you who are going through depression, because Psalm 77, Asaph did not hesitate to express his feelings about God. And he said, my soul is troubled, my sleep is gone, my spirit has no rest, my whole mind and soul, I can't sleep, I cannot even speak. But about 18 times in those first five verses, I, me, my, about 18 times. Then there is five rhetorical questions. And there's a pivot that takes place. And the rest of that chapter, there's not one I, me, my. It's all his attributes, his character, his nature, his ways. And that's when Asaph made the shift from I, me, my, no sleep, no speech, troubled soul, silence, to rejoicing because he turned the gaze Godward. So brokenness, very brief treatment of the topic, but remember, Satan is begging permission to prove we are hypocrites. And yet as we understand that God is in control, God will control, and nothing gets out of his control. It's his plan. It is perpetual. It is painful and it's purposeful. But we have to understand that purpose, and that is to glorify him, to give this world a right opinion of the nature and the character of our God. And more than likely, you will not escape life without painful breaking in order that that manifestation of his glory might be seen. Any questions real quickly? We have a few, 2 or 3 minutes here. Any question you would like to ask? I know we've moved quickly through this, but you might have something in your mind that would be. And again, we could probably go for 4 hours straight on this and just barely touch this. Yes.
What are the passages, you mentioned Psalm 77, but what are the passages when you're specific over the times of brokenness?
Dealing with Hebrews chapter 12 is and then 1 Thessalonians 5:23, I pray God your whole spirit, soul, and body. Another reference that I use is, except a grain of wheat fall in the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bears much fruit. And what it is a picture of that external shell has to rot before fruit can be produced. And I picture that I am spirit, soul, and body. The inner man is the spirit. That's my regeneration. The soul is my sanctification, and some make them two, one. But that's the sanctification process. That's where the breaking takes place in my mind, will, and emotion. And then the body would be the cooperator. The body doesn't cause anything. It simply follows the dictates of the soul, what the mind and the will tell it to do. And so when you look at the whole idea that Jesus is teaching what the grain of wheat falling in the ground and dying, but I could take a grain of wheat and take it here and display it, polish it, and say, that is a beautiful grain of wheat. I've never seen one so polished. It's worthless until it's put in the ground and moisture rots that shell and the life that is within is released. And to me, that would be the ultimate picture of my indwelling spirit when I become a believer, that the soulish part of me has to break to release the indwelling power to work out through me. And that's Romans 6. I acknowledge when Christ died, I died. When he raised, I raised. I acknowledge that. Then secondly, that chapter says, appropriate that to you. And then number three, the verbs, apply it to me. The verbs yield. Neither yield your members as instruments of unrighteousness. So Romans 6 would be the picture of us identifying in his death, burial, and resurrection. We acknowledge when he died, I died. When he raised, I raised. I now have the power in me. I acknowledge that. Then when temptation comes, I appropriate that power so that I do not yield in my soul my members to unrighteousness, but I yield them to righteousness. And but to me, the picture, for me to treat this in a longer period of time, I would have put this all on a, I mean, I have it all on PowerPoint. I didn't have the PowerPoint sent, but where it shows the steps from the indwelling spirit to that soul, to the control. But that's where I pray, God, your whole spirit, soul, body be preserved blameless in that breaking process. Hebrews 12 summarizes all of that, where allows the chastening that comes in to produce in us a holiness. I don't know if that answers your question or not. I mean, there are a lot more references that you could cross-reference on the whole concept, but it's basically dying to myself to be alive unto him. But the soulish part of me has to rot so that the power indwelling can be released. Sometimes I hesitate to even say that because people accuse me of being Keswick. I'm not even borderline Keswick. But anyway, that's oftentimes what that is. Any other question before we pray and dismiss? Yes. I think number one, his sovereignty. Number two, his perfect love. His sovereignty, he is in control. And his perfect love, he cares every detail about me. And the fact of his caring. That is, he told Moses, I know you by name. I know everything about you. Psalm 139 would be a great passage for you to meditate on that, the attributes of God and the nature of how he knows us and how he loves us and how he cares. So those would be the top three that I would say. God knows, he is absolutely in control. He loves me with a perfect love, would never allow something in my life that's going to be a hurt to me that would draw me away from him. That's always to push to him. And then indwelling spirit that would cause the gentleness to be manifested of his character, the caring. 1 Peter 5:7, casting all your cares upon him because he cares for you. Okay, our time is gone, but I appreciate this opportunity. Thank you for coming, and I apologize that we didn't have about 4 hours to plow through these with discussions, but hopefully these little guidelines will help. Okay, you're dismissed.